ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey folks, I'm Erin Park, host of the podcast series Expanse, Nowhere Man. A quarter of a century after he deliberately disappeared into the Great Sandy Desert, American Robert Baggucci is coming back for the first time. It turns out there's unfinished business that needs to be resolved.
I really don't think they understood.
We've got a lot of people missing.
Be careful.
It remains a mystery.
You can binge all episodes now of Expanse, Nowhere Man.
He's often described as a liberal moderate, but that's a label this MP is uncomfortable with, suggesting that his liberalism doesn't come in moderation. And while the member for Goldstein, Tim Wilson, spent a term in the political wilderness after losing his seat to an independent, he narrowly won it back at the 2025 election. In fact, he was the only Liberal to win a seat back from a Teal. In returning to Canberra, he's been eager to bring the Liberal Party back to its economic roots and has been openly ambitious about his future in the party. So how does Tim Wilson see the future of the party and his role in it? In the final sitting week of 2025, I sat down with the MP to hear more about the person behind the politics. And just a really important note to acknowledge, this was recorded before the devastating events in Bondi that targeted Jewish Australians on December the 14th. Welcome to Politics Now, the interview, Tim Wilson.
Thank you, PK.
Who is Tim Wilson?
Who is he? He's a kid who grew up in Melbourne, in the CBD, and then grew up on the Mornington Peninsula. What do you want to know?
How do you see Tim Wilson?
How do I see Tim Wilson? I see Tim Wilson as a pretty complex character. I grew up in a family that, was small business people, ran pubs. That kind of shaped my worldview. I have a kind of worldview which is very live and let live, about how I want relate to other people, very non-judgmental, but has a provocative relationship to power. The easiest way to get me to do something is to tell me I'm not able to do it, and a somewhat cheeky demeanour at times. I think that comes through pretty clearly. But someone who's also very determined because I think, I can see Australian society going down a really challenging path. I think it's going down a very challenging path. And I think it needs clear-eyed leadership of people who want to focus on how to bring it together, who want to steer it through these difficult times and actually build the future of the country. And I think I have a role to play in that.
So what led you into politics then? Because you're a bit of a political animal.
I'm not sure that's how I describe myself. What led me into politics was the first degree I studied at university, most people don't know, was I studied a Bachelor of Fine Art majoring in painting.
What?
Yes, I'm originally a painter. Yeah, and quite a good one.
Well, if you do say so yourself, tell me.
Well, I was at the time.
Tell me about it, though. That means like what, in high school, I'm assuming, like when you were young, you liked art?
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I did painting and printmaking. As I got towards the second half of my secondary school, I had a crisis of confidence around my sexuality, which is not a particularly unique thing. But the one thing that I could control and I knew that I was good at was art. I was struggling with keeping focus on other things. And so I used that as a pathway, which I thought I was going to use to get into TAFE, but actually got into university at Monash. And so I used that as a pathway to get into there. But once I got into university, I obviously lifted the veil, shall we say, or came out of the closet or whatever expression we want to use. But I kind of got into a heated discussion with my one of my lecturers who was during the middle of the GST debate, and they were saying that all art materials as of Monday, because the Howard government had just been re-elected, were going to go up by 10%. Now, I can't remember what the actual wholesale sales tax rate was on art supplies at the time. But I remember getting into a heated exchange and they sort of said, we're not sure you should be doing this. We think you should perhaps be studying something else. And that was sort of part of it. It also went back to growing up in the early 90s in Melbourne and living the consequences of the recession then. And what I remember, yes, there was obviously an economic breakdown, but I was kind of too young to remember that or to understand that. But what I remember was the human consequences, particularly friends who lost homes, families that broke up. And that very much informed, well, what's going on, or started to inform my judgment about what's going on here. What does this mean for society? What's the consequences of economic decline and how it breaks apart families? And as I observed that, then watched the rebirth during the Kennett era and obviously aspects of the Howard government nationally, and then at university overlaid that with a kind of intellectual framework, shall we say, it drove me to think very strongly about what makes for a good society, how do we want to build it, how should we use power to empower people versus central authority. And I very much landed on the let's empower people, families and communities and small business.
So in high school, I want to take you back to that. You're struggling with your sexuality. Mm-hmm. You're right. Not an uncommon story, you know, putting my hand up for a friend, myself. It's pretty common and it does bring out different sides of you, right? Like, you know, you become aware of different elements of your own character. You say painting was your thing, art was your thing. Did you think of yourself on the political spectrum? Were you thinking of politics? Did you think of yourself as a kind of right winger at the time?
Well, I thought of myself in a liberal tradition. I didn't really think in terms of left or right. But what I thought of was, I thought, again, going back to that, what I said before around the idea of how do you build a good society? And I believe very strongly in family, community, and small business, and that was how you built the foundations of a good society.
But you were never like a lefty at school, like a lot of people are, right?
No.
It's often a rite of passage, right?
No. I'm not one of those people who went down a path and then had this awakening one day and then went to the extreme opposite. I've always been, and I accept that some people will contest this, but I've actually always been a sort of very kind of centre-right mainstream person. I have very deep-rooted ideas about values, about human rights, and always have. That's some of the points where I get into arguments with people on the left because I take those very seriously. Because I also, looking at the lessons of history, look at, and yes, it's informed by, how would people like me have been treated throughout history? And it's not just my sexuality, it's my ethnic background.
Which is?
I'm a quarter Armenian. And so, of course, the first genocide of the 20th century in the modern era was against the Armenians.
Mm-hmm.
Liberals, being in the classical sense like me, have been targeted by most authoritarian regimes as well because they're often subversive because they challenge authority. And so I just look at these sorts of periods in history and you look at how power can be abused, and it naturally leads me to be very skeptical of central authority, government, large corporates, anybody who wants to abuse power.
I want to take you to the struggle over the sexuality, because I think that is a really important formative part of someone's identity, especially the struggle part, right? The bit of not. What were you worried about?
Well, I was a kid growing up on the Mornington Peninsula at the time, and it was probably a more closed community than it is now. The whole world was, because we sort of forget now that we've got devices on that I'm holding in my hand.
You can connect to anything.
How much smaller the world was. But it was also just you didn't know anybody like you, or if you did, or the only people you saw in popular media was either what I describe as the funny uncle or the dying AIDS patient. And then, of course, we're in the back end of that era. But it was just the idea that you weren't going to be accepted. And so you weren't going to be accepted in the community or the place that you were rejected from your family, but that you had no one you could talk to about it. And I spoke about this in my first speech.
For six of them, I let fear decide and determine who I could be. It wasn't until I was 18 that I chose to confront that fear. It was a fear that took an energetic 12-year-old and hollowed his confidence to eventually doubt his legitimate place in the world. Yet it was within those depths that I found my deeper, inner strength. And as tormenting as that experience was, it is what has made me strong. I carry the confidence of knowing I have already conquered my worst bully.
My worst bully was the doubt in my own mind. And this is not, an uncommon story. I think a lot of people who've gone through that journey will understand that, but I think for people who haven't, they won't understand it. It's the own sense of doubt that's the most corrosive thing to you. And so I think it was an immensely challenging period of my life. It was one that took me to one of the most challenging points, let's just put it that way, in my life, where, you know, I genuinely questioned whether I had a place in this world. But it also takes you then to know fear and also to overcome that fear. And so I think it, when sometimes people look at me with my, probably what you'd say is pretty high risk appetite, and my lack of fear, it comes from having a comfort knowing that place and knowing that I can get through it too.
Were you worried about the Liberal Party, the conservative side of politics, and its ability to allow you to rise?
Well, I was 16, 17, I was painting at the time. So no, I wasn't thinking about that.
As you became politically active, which you did by uni, right?
Yeah, but actually no, I actually found when I joined the Liberal Party at the age of 18, it actually very closely correlated with when I came out. And there were actually a lot of openly gay men, lesbian women and transgender people who were members of the Liberal Party as well. And did I think it might potentially impact, look, I'm not going to try and pretend it wasn't, but that was a societal thing. It wasn't specific there. There was obviously a chunk of people who were very conservative in the Liberal Party, but no, I wasn't actually.
Because that was a strong, I mean, I remember that time, right? Yeah. Like, we are not a dissimilar age. I remember.
So we're both young.
Yeah,
way, we'll get away with that.
The way you can flip that. But I remember all the time you're talking about, I remember. Yeah, yeah. And I remember the Howard government. And the Howard government was not overly warm to the gays.
No, well, I mean, not in
comparison. I mean, it wasn't.
Not in comparison to anything like now. And now we're sort of in this kind of post period. Well, that's how it sort of feels. So it was a different time. But did it bother me or worry me? I mean, you're assuming that I joined because I wanted to end up sitting behind this microphone. That actually wasn't the motivation.
You must have thought about it.
I'm not going to try and pretend I didn't think about it, but I'm not saying it was my motivation. My motivation was I had an increasingly strong view about what makes a good society. You know, I am not somebody who's taken a full frontal lobotomy when I joined the political party of my choice. I still very much challenge it every day. You can pick up the newspapers and identify that. I didn't see that there was any dramatic conflict. I did think that probably I sat in a component of the tradition, but it didn't bother me. But of course, as time has gone on, the issues evolved, and one of the issues, of course, that the party had to confront was occurred explicitly during my time, and that was actually one of the second most challenging periods probably of my life, because you had this incredible tension of conflict between what I would say is loyalty to my then partner, now husband, my party, the community I was representing, and of course the promises you made to everybody, and how do you navigate and reconcile that?
How did you, especially with your partner, and can I name him, Ryan?
Ryan's sufficiently in the public square that
exactly.
He can be named.
Oh, just checking.
We both know this issue isn't the reason we got involved in politics. Give us tax reform any day. But in my first speech, I defined our bond by the ring that sits on both of our left hands, and that they are the answer to the questions we cannot ask. So there's only one thing left to do. Ryan Patrick Bolger, will you marry me?
And I imagine was raising with you that he was not loving this time.
No, neither of us did because it was this point of tension. I mean, we went into it, the debate, knowing that it was going to come up. It obviously was in the first full year of when I was in Parliament. But what we wanted was resolution, and we weren't alone in that. A lot of people who the issue affected wanted the country to move on. And it wasn't just about being personal. So you don't like watching your life being debated in the public square. But the way we dealt with it was we communicated in the same way that I navigated with my party membership. I was very open and honest with them about the conflict and the challenges. Same with, obviously, the parliamentary party. And we got to a point, obviously, that resolved it. You know, was it the way that I wanted to? No, but I'm also the first to acknowledge that because of the way we resolved it, it's meant that we haven't, one, had a backlash. Those who were defeated accepted the loss. But more importantly, we haven't seen any attempt at reversal, and we never will. And it's allowed the country to move on. And so that's, so there are blessings or silver linings.
You're often described, and I know you challenge this, but as a moderate. How do you see that label?
Well, I'm not a big fan because, firstly, the media likes to put you in the camp of moderate or conservative. Now, I'm definitely not a conservative. The conservatives will agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the moderates will say, well, we're not sure he's really a moderate either, because the reason I don't use the term moderate is because my liberalism doesn't come in moderation. I have very strong views. And, it, you know, I wrote about it in my book in 2020, The New Social Contract, New Liberal Vision for Australia. But I have very assertive views about how do you build a good society, why it's important, and I don't like falling for the idea. I think you can be boxed in if you're defined as a moderate as kind of, well, what the progressive left wants, but just not as soppy. That's not my worldview. I look at a lot of conservatives a lot of the time and go, I think you're being soppy on various issues.
What are they soppy about?
Well, I think I don't really want this podcast to turn into an explosive interview, but there are times where I look and go, you're just caving into what the left actually wants. And I'm not going to get into the details.
You have to give me an example.
Well, I'm now trying to think one off the top of my head because there have definitely been ones recently. Sometimes I certainly accept the framing of debates. And I think the one obviously that I've been vocal about recently has been the binary nature of climate policy. And I think and I've been very clear with people that I think that we've fallen for a false choice on that because I don't think the choice that people wanted to set up of pro-net zero, anti-net zero is actually the correct decision in what it is we're trying to achieve in public policy. But if you just set up debates and accept the terms of the debate, you'll end up losing because if you're responding, the debate by its nature is set up in the first point to be defeated. So I have an assertive view on liberalism. I'm not afraid to stand up for it. I remember I was watching an episode of Insiders and one commentator, Paul Sakal, made the observation that I was unique because I'm not afraid to argue in favour of people making a profit. And I'm not. But you actually don't hear many people in this building say that anymore.
Mm.
I'm not afraid of standing up for people. Yeah, I actually believe that people should have aspiration. They should get wealthy. We should build a country where people set their eyes further to the horizon and that I'm unapologetic in that.
There's profit. No one's arguing that there's excessive profit.
Sure.
I think that's often actually the binary, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't have to be the binary.
Are you cool with excessive profit?
Well, define excessive.
I'm not going to.
Well, that doesn't give me what to work with. I accept that there's a genuine conversation about inequality. And that I actually want a society where that's open, where people can get ahead. One of the things I'm most concerned about is where you actually have entrenched privilege, which makes it harder or makes it impossible for the next generation to get ahead. And without wanting to labour it, it's because this is what I did write about back when nobody was talking about this issue in 2020 in my book, because I see this as one of the big structural challenges for our society. If you entrench privilege, if you entrench people's position through different components of the tax and transfer system and don't make sure you have open economic systems, it denies those who want to put their energy and their effort into building their own future a pathway. And, and I always say this, if you're a party of aspiration, you've got to be on the side of the aspiring. You've got to fight for the aspiring. Who are the aspiring? They're the next generation and they're new Australians. And we always have to be on their side.
What's your red line, a principle you hold that you will never compromise on?
Ooh, a red line, a principle. I'm very hard line on equality before the law. And so I sometimes get into debates. Yesterday I was talking to a rabbi about some of the debates around free speech over years. And my position on free speech has always been, whatever the line is, it must apply equally. And we've had debates in the past around some of the anti-discrimination law, which doesn't treat everybody equally. And it's a really important principle to me because human history is replete with what happens when laws apply to people differently. And give people sectional interests. I don't believe in group rights, never have, never will. However we want to cut it, I'm very against the idea of identity politics. And so equality before law as a principle is extremely important to me.
So what would you ideally like to change then?
Well, actually, I think one of the enduring strengths of the Australian political system is actually that we've taken equality before the law very seriously. There's obviously been, there'll always be components of laws where there's kind of grey lines and it's how far we move them up or down. But, you know, I'm not going to launch into bold policy pronouncements on your podcast or certainly not outside of my portfolio area. But anything that seeks to shift that, you'll often see me arguing from a very hardline position of equality before law, because it's just a simple proposition that it's one of the reasons I believe in democracy so much. Everybody gets to have an equal say.
Mm. On that principle, though, of equality before the law, I think about that big debate, the 18C debate.
Yep.
You were part of that.
Sure.
Do you still hold those views?
Well, do I still believe in equality before law?
Said yes. You've just framed that in a particular way, but you know.
Well, that was my motivation.
And do you remember what happened? You ended up that the government actually dumped these reforms. This was diabolical politically. But do you still believe it was the right thing?
Well, do I still believe that we should have laws that treat people equally on the basis of harassment? Of course, I do. You know, I often say this. You know, I find it extraordinary that we have laws that deal with harassment on the basis of somebody's ethnicity, but we say go nuts on people on the basis of their disability. I sent a submission to the Senate at the time saying the way through this debate is to say we should set a standard that applies to everybody equally. But I equally don't agree with the Tasmanian anti-discrimination law, which is what 18C was designed on, where you had Catholic priests being dragged to tribunals for arguing they believe marriage was between a man and a woman. I mean, I think that's insane. It's not pluralistic. It doesn't believe in diversity. People, firstly, are entitled to have difference of opinion if you believe in diversity. But it's also the unequal application of the law. So that's the basis. I mean, my views on those sorts of things will never change. What can politically be achieved is a different matter. That's obviously not a political priority for anybody right now and needs to come up as part of a broader conversation.
If you weren't a politician, what would you be?
I think I said I'd be a painter.
So you would have?
No, I don't know. Would I have gone on to become a painter?
Being a painter,
when I was a kid, I wanted to be a marine biologist.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
But what I wanted to say about the painter thing is it's quite an isolated practice, and people who are really social struggle with it. And I find that you...
Well, I think that's why I retreated to it. Because it was an isolating practice, I could be by myself. I'm not exactly somebody absent social connection. Mm. Obviously, I had a 3-year walkabout period, and part of it challenged me about what it is I do. And I did consulting and worked with startups, and that was all very interesting and entertaining. But I don't find making money interesting.
Even though you believe people should be making heaps of it.
Well, I believe that people should be able to pursue what they want to do, and I want to channel their energy towards the right purpose. And yeah, I mean, I'm not offended by money. I still need it. Everybody needs it, and I want people to be productive. But I'm not motivated by it at all. And so I just kind of, every time I've gone and done things in business, it just hasn't given that sense of fulfillment in the way that I get from public service, but also for doing things for the public good.
That's so interesting, Tim. See, the actual work of making money in business is something you don't overly love.
Well, I just don't find it rewarding because at the end of the day, it's essential, but the satisfaction you get from helping people is so much more rewarding. And trying to build, and I accept in this building, people will have it, you know, to completely disagree with the type of country I want to build, and that'll be amongst your audiences, and there'll be people who completely agree, and there'll be huge shades in between. But it's just the most satisfying thing that you can do. I mean, it's also very taxing. It's exhausting if you put all your energy into it. And, of course, it comes with scrutiny, accountability, and it's not without huge cost.
What leader do you look up to?
So I look up to a number of leaders, but for different things. So one of my heroes is a woman by the name of Pauline Sabin. Have you ever heard of her?
Tell me more.
Exactly, I know. Pauline Sabin was an American Republican, and she fought for the introduction of prohibition. I know.
I'm loving this.
Then changed her mind, left her party, and then led the campaign to repeal the Prohibition Amendment in the US Constitution. Another one's a very distant cousin of mine, a woman by the name of Catherine Stewart Murray. she was an anti-suffragette who then went on and became the first woman elected to Westminster for Scotland and was the first first woman Minister of State. She resigned from her own Conservative government to try and topple her own Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, to try and stop the outbreak of the Second World War. I admire, he's not a politician, but...
It's two women so far.
Yeah, Milton Friedman, because he explained economics with a smile. And I liked particularly Ronald Reagan's sunny optimism and his communication ability. But the political philosophy that I think probably best anchors mine, and I think what I admire about him more and more is his understanding of the Australian way of life and how it fuses with politics, is actually just the founder of my party, Robert Menzies. And, you know, it's a bit of a trope to go back there, but I genuinely do feel that he has this catalyzing, and not because of longevity of service, catalyzing understanding about what was the purpose of this nation, because we're not a nation that has this kind of story, which is built on a baptism of fire of, you know, civil war or anything like that. It was largely administrative. But he had this understanding of how to translate that politically into a governing philosophy that fulfilled people's needs and obviously made people proud to be Australian. But actually some of his speeches, particularly his latter years, were really fascinating, insightful, because he was deeply challenging on in a way that Labor mischaracterised him. They liked to demonise him. But around diversity, he gave some amazing speeches talking about new Australians and how they should be themselves. He explicitly fought against the idea, and this is just radical. I'm not trying to project him onto more contemporary debates, but fought against the legal definition of marriage because he said it should evolve with society. It's
wild.
He's a really interesting character, but he just had this view that and a faith in democracy.
How do you want to be remembered?
I think everyone in political life would like to be remembered favourably. We all do.
I think that's a truism for everything, right?
Yeah. But I'm only really interested in being remembered for what it is that I did. You know, one day there'll be a time and I know I'll go off this mortal coil and hopefully someone will cry, hopefully my husband.
let's hope.
But there'll be, you just want to get remembered doing what you did. And hopefully people say, well, at least they made a good wicket of it, because my view is, and it does go back to my teenage years, but, you know, when you go to that deep sense of doubt to the point where you question the legitimacy of your place in this world, it breathes into you an idea that, you know, your time is precious, what you have to contribute is precious, and that you're here to do things. And so I just have this view that I'm here and that I'm going to make it could end at any moment, so you got to do everything you can. And people look at it and go, well, he certainly didn't waste any time, did he? And he did things that hopefully improved people's lives, but at least he did what he believed in.
Do you see yourself as a future leader of the Liberal Party?
Look, I think there's a scenario where that can happen, but I think events will have to turn in my favour. But I didn't come here to explicitly be the leader. I have said many times I did come to lead, though, because I do believe my country and my party needs leadership. And I think more importantly, it needs a certain intellectual leadership about where it should be heading and who it should be fighting for. And, you know, over the next coming months, you'll see how I plan to go about doing that, because I think... political parties, if they're just seen as sort of custodians of political values or traditions, it's not enough. They have to be seen to be out there fighting for people and enlivening people's sense of ambition and dreams if people actually then want to connect with them enough they want to fight for them too.
Do you think the Liberal Party room is capable of electing a gay man? As their federal leader?
Well, I think they're quite capable of electing a leader, and whether whatever their sexuality or anything else, you think it will be irrelevant? Secondary. Well, I'm not going to say that some people won't factor it in, as they look at any calculus in electing a leader. But do I think it'll be the primary consideration like it was once these days? Nah. I think it's going to be a completely different conversation about who is going to be the answer to the problem the party faces at a time. and that's actually going to be the driver. But I think sometimes these sorts of unique contributions that you can make can sometimes be an asset, but sometimes it's not revealed until you get there.
Tim, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Pleasure.
That's it for this episode of Politics Now's special summer series, The Interview. All summer, we'll be bringing you the people behind the politics. So follow Politics Now on the ABC Listen app so you never miss an episode.